This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. The reason I'm using a microphone is because we're recording today's session, not because this is a Nuremberg-style audience. My name is Peter Stanley, and it's my pleasure to run the Museum's Centre for Historical Research. We've scheduled this session today as one of our occasional seminars to capitalise on the visit to Canberra of Dr. Jeff McGarrigy, who will be introduced to you presently by the chair of today's discussion, which is Dr. Mike Pickering over in the corner there. The reason we've scheduled this is that we realised with Jeff's imminent visit to Canberra that there were connections between several institutions and several members of staff of those institutions. That is that as you'd imagine, Jeff, working at the US National Holocaust Memorial Museum, deals with a subject which is by its nature traumatic. And I realised that there was a connection between his work and the work of the National Museum and indeed the National Library, in that we too deal with subjects which are unpleasant, uncomfortable, traumatic. And the substance of today's discussion will flesh out that observation. So the purpose of today's conversation is to bring together people who ordinarily wouldn't even know each other, but by happenstance we can bring people together who can share and compare and look across their interests into similar human situations, which is a very opaque way of describing what we're doing today, but it will be made clear by Mike and our speakers, whom Mike will introduce. So can I say thank you for coming. Feel free to eat your lunch. We'll go until, I guess, about 1:45 or more, if you've got more to ask and to say. So please feel free to, first of all, listen, and then to take part in a conversation on understanding and representing traumatic experience. Over to Mike Pickering. Thank you.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for coming. Good to see people arrive. We're a bit nervous there. I was thinking I'd probably set a precedent by reading out the names of all those curators who didn't show up, knowing that they would be enshrined in our podcast forever. But it's given that I often miss them myself, it's probably not a good precedent. If we treat this as a discussion, not a lecture, there'll be a discussion between the panellists, but also hopefully a discussion with you, the audience. This comes out as I was sitting there thinking, you know, 3 weeks ago it was, can I chair this session on trauma? Yep, no worries. The closer the event comes, the more you start to question, what is trauma? And you realise how little you actually know about how you might define trauma or what constitutes traumas and whose traumas are we talking about. And it's that diversity of experience which exists not only here with our panel, but I'm sure amongst the audiences. So any corporate discussion should be rewarding for all of us. We have our four main speakers, plus myself, who will interrupt whenever I feel like it. It's one of the privileges of being the chair. We have Jeff, of course, from the Holocaust Museum in Washington. I'm very pleased to have you here. Thank you for him. Joanna Sassoon from the National Library. And Jay and Adele, who are working here at the museum. I'm sure they are familiar faces to everybody. All have engaged in various projects over their careers, which involve issues of trauma or distress, working closely with informants, with people who have various episodes in their lives or various groups that have episodes in their lives which come to the fore in the nature of their engagements. Of particular relevance here is Joanna, Jay and Adele are working on the Forgotten Australians and Former Child Migrant Project, which is following the apology, I think it was last year, that money was put into developing both researching these people, the experiences of Forgotten Australians and child migrants, and also in the development of an exhibition. So the sequence we will see is we'll talk through basically ideas and research and the processes behind engaging with the client base, you know, the of people who have suffered these traumas. Then leading on to how we might tell those stories through both exhibitions and publications. How do we deliver the story to a public and what sort of issues arise in delivering the story to the public? As for myself, it raises a number of questions and also reflects issues in my career. Working in Indigenous studies, of course, in Australia, it's impossible not to be confronted by trauma. I can think of having worked with men and women who had been shot in their lifetimes. Of course, they'd been peppered with shotgun pellets because they were being cheeky by station owners. I've met people who've been whipped and beaten. What always intrigued me was how few of them carried any animosity towards myself as a white anthropologist entering their communities. They would tell these stories about their mistreatment at the hands of other whites, yet there was no visible animosity, although it was part of their experience. So how do people manage trauma? I'm also intrigued by the life of people who suffer trauma, traumatic experiences. Every Anzac Day, every time there's a military march, I tend to observe that the combatants, people who were prime combatants in those battles of the past, become fewer and fewer compared, and most of the marches become people who are off in non-combatant zones or in service industries which provided. Now, is that a reflection of just the general percentage of a 10-to-1 percentage of distribution in the forces? Or is it a result of people who suffered the greatest traumas dying young or removing themselves from the episode? I don't know. It's just what is the long-term effect of trauma on the individual and how often that trauma becomes invisible. Finally, with my own experience, I'm currently on a small committee which is advising the 9/11 Memorial Museum in New York on the ethics of displaying objects that may be contaminated by microscopic traces of human remains. This is down from the 9/11 attacks. So many people were effectively vaporized, and the dust contaminated not only lots of objects but also most of New York. And so in developing this museum, they are displaying objects contaminated with dust, which is known to be contaminated with vaporized or burnt human tissue. And they're looking at it with an intensity, DNA analysis, close scrutiny, that I don't believe has ever happened in the past. Have we changed the way we look at trauma? There's now more consultation with the families of those victims. Their opinions are being taken on. There's a much more consideration of ethics. Yet 100 years ago, or 50 years ago, whenever we've been developing exhibitions or collections post-trauma, World War II, World War I, Korean War, and so on, similar events, these issues didn't seem to be as important about the idea of displaying a uniform that was worn in battle. Go to the War Memorial, and they have the Gallipoli landing craft on display with its bullet holes. There's no consideration, or has there been any consideration, about the contamination of such objects. So were these issues considered but have since become invisible over time because they were never documented, or have people always considered? So how we address trauma is changing, and it's certainly affecting the work we do here at the museum. A lot of curators will deal with trauma often without knowing it, not without knowing that the trauma, which the events that were implicit in the objects they are handling. And I'm sure that everybody here has at some stage or another come into contact with such materials or such experiences, even if not through a museum experience, in their home experience. So that's enough from me. I think there will be lots of questions that will arise, in particularly questions of definition and experiences. We'll start off with Joanna.
Thank you, Peter, for the invitation. I work in the National Library, which, as probably most of you would know, has a national documentation role, which takes a very long view of what it is that we collect and why we collect, and things that we collect are maintained permanently. So I come from a slightly different collecting context in some ways to the National Museum. There's a lot of debate within libraries about our role as collectors and how we shape collections, but that's really not the point of discussion for today. I'm just making the point that the library sometimes comes from a slightly different perspective to museums and other collecting institutions. I'm also talking from the perspective of being the project manager for the Forgotten Australians and Former Child Migrants Oral History Project, which is one strand of what the former Prime Minister called the National History Projects, and he announced these National History Projects as part of the national apology to former Australians and forgotten Australians and former child migrants apology that he gave in Parliament House in November last year. So the National Museum is one partner, the Australian National Maritime Museum is another, and the National Library provides the third pillar in that process. This oral history project is going to be, and is already, interviewing adults whose children were in care. And it'll also, as well as interviewing adults whose children were in care, it will include interviewing spouses, siblings, advocates and employees, because we're looking at a whole range of different issues about trauma, not just the, and it's not only trauma that we're looking at, but we're looking at the experiences, not only on the people who went through it, but on people around them as well. Just by where we're up to with the project, we have been recruiting interviewers nationally, and I've been training them across the country this year. And so far, the library's completed 21 interviews, and with the permission of everybody who has been interviewed, these interviews will be placed online on an ongoing basis. But our first batch will be released as a part of the anniversary of the apology in a few weeks' time. Now, I'm just going to be talking very generally about my observations and experience of working with people who've had a range of experiences that some people would think is traumatic, both at the individual level and at the community level. I'm no expert in psychological trauma, but I guess I've worked around this area and possibly lived with some aspects of it at times in my life, as most people, I think, have when we start talking about these experiences. But what do we mean when we say trauma? And in the context, I think, that most of us are talking about, it's psychological trauma. What it really is a psychological injury resulting from being in a stressful or a life-threatening situation. How it pans out is another whole set of questions altogether. The project that I'm on will document a range of stories about the context of lives before and after being in care, as well as the experiences of being in care. So we're doing whole-of-life interviews. We're not just looking at the experience that we would first think is traumatic, but is not necessarily actually the site of trauma. This project will be documenting the diversity and the complexity of the experiences of people whilst in care, and it will be documenting the diversity of the lifelong impact of those experiences which surround the person's experiences of being in care. Now, the impact of the experience of being in care, that is, prior to being placed in care, of being in care, and the life after being in care, the impact of those experiences is incredibly diverse and incredibly variable. And it is also incredibly unpredictable. How one person perceives, experiences, and overcomes an experience or a set of experiences may be entirely different to someone else in a similar situation. And when you've got siblings talking about their experiences and their perceptions of the same situation and the impact of that set of experiences, you start to think there are other factors at play. So how people respond to and overcome experiences are often influenced by other factors which come into play beyond that actual set of circumstances themselves. And that goes into the capacity of the individual to bound back from the experience or steel themselves in the face of such events. This is actually the human quality of resilience, that is, the capacity to cope with stress or adversity in a variety of forms. So when you're dealing with the experiences of adults who are children in care, you start to see resilience as a sort of childhood developmental process. And it's a really interesting part of the project that I'm working on. It's something I'm quite interested in, even though I don't have an expertise in the area. And there are a large range of complex factors which enable individuals to build resilience to traumatic events. Or you also find other people who find it hard to build that capacity as well. And the capacities behind building a resilience often relate to broader familial and social contexts, as well as specific experiences at specific ages. For instance, if someone takes notice of your interest or gives you affection or takes you out or models a particular type of behaviour, that can have a huge impact on your life. Likewise, whether your whole life experience is validated, understood, believed by individuals or a community, and that's the context in which we're working, whether someone believes you, whether the society believes that that experience ever happened, also has an impact on your resilience over your lifetime. Now, some of the really difficult experiences that I've heard so far in the interviews that we've conducted reveal the extraordinary resilience of the human spirit to survive, to process, to understand the experiences, and quite often as children, to continue to resist the system and exert considerable agency over their own lives, both within the institutions or in the being in care and afterwards. However, other experiences have left people with the sense that they're lifelong victims. So what I'm saying is you just don't know what you're dealing with all the time. But this oral history project aims to document the diverse range of experiences and also the diversity of the impacts of those experiences that people have had throughout their lives, who at one moment in their life or for a long period in their life happen to be in the care of other people apart from their family. So when I'm commissioning interviews, I really don't know what the interviewer is going to experience or how the interviewee is going to respond emotionally when discussing the experiences that they've had. For the most part, what I have from the person who I've selected to be interviewed is a handwritten experience. They've often just expressed an interest. They've self-selected at the moment because we have yet to really rack up our media. And perhaps a staff member in the library has had contact with the individual. So we don't have an awful lot of information to give people who are going to go into that interview situation. And until you're in that interview situation, when people are actually remembering and sometimes even playing out their childhood experiences or the distress that they have experienced or the way that they have said they have survived, you really don't know how people are going to respond to the process of remembering when it's on a one-to-one with a recorder in front of them. However, our responsibility as employers to these interviewers and also to the interviewees is to anticipate how people may respond and also then skill them up so that they know what to do in certain situations. Now, the impact of an experience, as I've said, or even the expression of a deep emotion can actually come from a range of feelings, not all bad, not all traumatic, but it's not always possible to read or see capacities like resilience, or you can't actually start to understand the lifelong impact of certain experiences on someone until you're in the room with them, looking and listening very, very carefully. And even then, when you think you've got the situation sort of sussed, sometimes things come out of left field. Emotions are very unpredictable. They often surprise the person who's telling the story. And the impact then of being interviewed can also re-traumatise people to a certain extent. So we've got lots of factors when we're starting to think about interviewing that we have to actually think about in these contexts. You really can never tell what's going to trigger an emotion or take someone back to a particular experience. Now, I'm sure all the girls here have walked down the street and smelt the deodorant of their first boyfriend 30 years later. I mean, they just take you straight back. Smells will take you straight back to experiences very, very quickly. Sounds can trigger memories as well. Imagining and remembering what the front door of an institution looks like can really trigger memories. Thinking about how you were told good news or how you were told bad news triggers memories and emotions. And when you're in an interview situation, you never quite know what the response is going to be to what you think is an open, neutral question. We actually have to be prepared for that fleeting moment which shifts from reflection in a rational situation to something entirely different. So my role in the project as the project manager is to provide a supportive environment for the interviewee and a framework of support for everyone who's involved in the project, and that actually includes me as well. This support starts with how we interact with people who express an interest in being interviewed for the project, through to their comfort at the idea of actually being interviewed for the public record for the longer term. The environment that they choose to be interviewed in, and that may mean having a support person there if that's what they want. Their individual need for post-interview debriefing, and their rights to control whether that interview becomes accessible during their lifetime. This support starts at the first interaction that we have with people, and it's been thought about very carefully even before that process, and continues well after the process of interviewing has been completed and a copy of the interview has been sent back to the person whose story they've told. So the library understands that the process of being interviewed may bring back a range of memories. The library deals with memories on a daily basis in its oral history projects. And we are prepared, and we prepare our interviewers in the best way that we can to deal with the full gamut of human emotions, human stories that may come to the fore in an interview process. So far in the project, the Forgotten Australians and Former Child Migrants process, everyone has found the interview process to be very supportive. And most who've had some concerns about it or who felt that they've had really very difficult stories have found the interview process personally very therapeutic. Everybody who's listened to interviews and who works on the project is bound to be touched by this experience. What you hear, you cannot help but be moved by. It's how we all learn to cope with those experiences. This is actually the trick. So how we build resilience in ourselves to deal with these situations is also an important part of the process of this oral history project. The other thing I just want to say is that I don't assume that anybody has either had a traumatic experience or hasn't, or has been traumatised by it, or is going to be traumatised by the retelling. I make no assumptions either way, because my experience with dealing with a range of people over a very long period of time is that you can show someone a map and they can burst into tears and you have absolutely no idea where it's coming from. So that you can't assume that people are always going to be traumatised by something and express it, and you can't assume that people aren't. We have to train people to go in with an open mind, equipped with the skills to deal with whatever it is that comes to them. So ultimately, we try to prepare all our interviewers in a way that they conduct the interviews ethically and sensibly, and we hope that our interviewees find that the processes that we put in place so that they can tell their story actually meet with their expectation. Thank you.
Thank you, Joanna. We'll now move over to Adele, who will talk about the National Museum's experiences in the same project.
Thanks, Mike. Firstly, just to say that I'm not assuming that my experiences are exclusive, that people here may have not had them themselves by doing curatorial work, nor that I'm an expert. So it's really a starting point for dialogue so that I may learn more. So thank you. I suppose what I want to talk about is... subtitled The Confessions of a Curator, but really about the intersection of social history and social work, which, of course, I'm not a social worker, never would claim to be, never, you know, the clear of the professional boundaries. However, I'm informed to a certain extent by Lois Silverman's book, The Social Work of Museums, in which she argues that as we go from natural history museums where the notion of the person as the object to social history where the person is the subject, that there are instances internationally, which she identifies, of where museums have done some kind of social work. So I'm just wanting to look at that from my experience working on this exhibition. It's easy to say that a curator should never engage in social work because that's unprofessional, mamby-pamby, a displacement from core business. But what is it about the work that I've been doing that might be perceived to go into the realms of social work? And that's about the process of engaging stakeholders who are victims of trauma, who suffer from depression and or post-traumatic stress disorder, and also complex post-traumatic stress disorder, which is another kettle of fish and really quite challenging symptoms there. And it's interesting, too, that Kevin Rudd, Joanna mentioned the apology, when Kevin Rudd introduced the three history projects as part of his apology, he talked about them from the perspective of the experiences of those who are institutions, their experiences, not some kind of objective scientific view, but the impetus from the experience of those individuals. So we do see a shift, the idea that the person's experiences are important. And that's, of course, not to say that they aren't varied, that they're not singular, and, of course, our exhibition will include all experiences, including positive. But the point is that it's from the view of the subject. So I've been working on this project for 9 months, and rightly or wrongly, within that time, I have visited forgotten Australians, many of whom live in poverty, and often the first interaction I get, are you the lady from the museum? Yes. Well, you can't leave your car there because it's not going to be there by the time you finish. I've also had forgotten Australians come and visit me under the influence here at the museum, under the influence of varying substances in their pyjamas. I've identified appropriate counsellors who have an understanding of the needs of forgotten Australians and referred stakeholders who have expressed a need for counselling after they've broken down when speaking to me. I've located emergency housing. I've administered first aid. I've travelled in the back of an ambulance. I've attended a health case conference. And I had an unexpected encounter with an alpaca in the corridor of a hospice. I wasn't aware that Fridays at Claire Holland House is Animal Therapy Day. And, of course, I regularly participate in counselling sessions for myself by a clinical psychologist who specialises in trauma. And he's really good at helping me define what is an appropriate duty of care and what are appropriate boundaries, and, of course, helping me with work-life balance. So that's where we see an intersection between social history and social work. Now, automatic responses to these episodes might be in a really caring, from a really caring and professional and experienced place, might be you shouldn't have to do that. You know, your job is to put together an exhibition and you're being manipulated into codependent interactions. You know, that may be, you know, a really caring and thoughtful response to what I do. And I even, you know, thought about whether I should talk about the things that I have done, lest I be labelled as an unprofessional curator. But I think these responses, whether caring or distant, are not symptomatic of the personalities of the people involved, but symptomatic of a systemic tension between social history and social work. So how do I end up in these situations, and should I? And where are the boundaries? The reason I end up in these situations is because the Forgotten Australians are not called that for nothing. A lot of Australians do not know that over 500,000 non-Indigenous children were in institutions. So what happens is these many Forgotten Australians who I've spoken to, when they have tried as adults to speak to professionals about their experience, they are not believed. So what's happened is I've had people ring me or write to me who have never told their story to anyone before. So the museum has been the first port of call. Now, I know that seems that's not what we're here for, but whether we like it or not, that's what's happened. And so with that first opening up comes that emotion. The fact that a national museum is taking on this project, it is perceived by many Forgotten Australians that suddenly their story has credibility where hitherto it didn't. So that's why I find myself in this situation. The museum is very attractive to Forgotten Australians at this point of time. And also because in order to source objects for the exhibition, Jay and I have to travel to visit Forgotten Australians, and we see them in their homes, and sometimes we see them during moments when they are not well. And so this is where I think the core business argument doesn't fit, because these episodes of administering care have occurred when I am undertaking the core business, and I have a duty of care not only as a fellow human being, but especially as a public servant and as a representative of the National Museum. And so what I am aware, though, is that I don't do the counselling, I don't find the housing, I don't administer the medical treatment, but what I will do is I will refer. The risk of this, of course, is the code of conduct for Australian public service, and is that it is easy and tempting to become the advocate when you administer care. So it's very important that I remain impartial. So again, I don't become the advocate. What I will do is refer Forgotten Australians to those advocacy organisations which are funded by the Australian government to do that. So that's one way to engage our stakeholders. The other thing I want to talk about is the work we're doing with the website. Again, that's seen as perhaps as an extension or something separate to the exhibition, but actually it's part and parcel. That one of the other things that comes with Forgotten Australians is that they do not have trust of authority figures, because their trust in authority figures was abused when they were children. And so to build up that trust, we have established a website in order to give Forgotten Australians a voice. And also to represent those personal narratives of those who may not be represented in the exhibition because it is a limited space. So, I mean, I've I have some words from some of the Forgotten Australians who have posted their narratives onto the site and why the site is so important to them. But perhaps we'll leave that for now and see if that comes up in conversation. But that's my
thank you. We now turn to Jay.
So, Adele and I are working together on the exhibition. Of course, the context of this exhibition is somewhat different from maybe another exhibition from the museum. You might decide to put on an exhibition on some community group in Australia or various reasons you might want to put on an exhibition. This comes out of the context of the Apology to the Forgotten Australians. So the exhibition itself is part of the healing process is too strong, but certainly an attempt by the government to recognise, anyway, this section of the community. And so it has a kind of particular context before it's even created. It will open next year on the second anniversary of the Apology, so it's already located within that conversation about the Apology to the Forgotten Australians and former child migrants. In forming this exhibition, however, we have included members of the Stolen Generations as well in part of this story, because we have located our exhibition on the subject of children's homes themselves, not foster care or other forms of care. Because of the limited size of our exhibition, we have just decided to take children's homes as our focus. And many children's homes had, which were white homes, had many Indigenous children in there, the children either knowing they're Indigenous or not, depending. But certainly we need to look at all three groups when looking at children's homes. Now, for many of our visitors, seeing this exhibition on children's homes wouldn't necessarily think this is an exhibition on trauma, because this whole subject has been so hidden and so forgotten and so put aside. People might have a kind of uneasy feeling about that children's home down the road. They have a feeling it's maybe not a good place, or they may just have a slightly shadowy feeling about it. They may not necessarily associate with trauma. Because our other audience, we have two audiences, the other audience, the men in these homes, knows the story all too well. And it's no simple trauma. We're not talking about a single simple trauma, as we've all been saying. It's a very complicated story. And basically, you have children who've been removed from their families for whatever reason. It's clearly an experience of trauma, to be taken from a family situation and brought up in an institution, whether it's a mild or serious or long-lasting or whatever. There's still an effect on that child. So society took the most vulnerable children in its care and placed them in a system which is unsafe and dysfunctional, which couldn't guarantee their physical, psychological or sexual safety, and couldn't guarantee they would receive education, nutrition or healthcare. So we have a kind of a sense of trauma, this a potential trauma. They're going to in a system which was potentially traumatic because it was unsafe. And the trauma we're dealing about in our exhibition will be only of the children, people who are former children in these homes. There's clearly a lot of associated trauma, as Joanna mentioned, with the parents who lost their children, with partners of people who've been in homes and therefore traumatised, and with their families. But again, because of our limited scope, we thought we would just concentrate on the experiences of people who were in care. And also, I think, too, because in a sense, this is their time. With the Apology, it was the Prime Minister saying, what you said was right, was real. We disbelieved you. Now it's your time. So it's their time to tell the story. So I think it's important that we respond in a museum to the time to tell something. And this is a time to tell the story of the trauma of children's homes. This trauma, of course, hasn't been told very largely, or if it was told, it wasn't believed. So it has a sense of being silenced. It is very complicated. I've talked to former residents of homes who've said, oh, you know, some people have a chip on their shoulder, referring to stories of sexual abuse or And another person I talked to said, of course, they've all experienced trauma, even though they don't admit it, you know. So it's up to us to respect that complexity and not assume, as Joanna's saying, assume that everyone has experienced the same kind of trauma or has the same kind of feelings from being in care. It's an incredibly complicated story. It's also a story of childhood trauma. Unfortunately for us, there's been a lot of discussion over the recent years, especially in particular about sexual abuse in childhood, when the kind of rhetoric that you can't believe what children say, they make it up, they forget, that has been a lot of argument against that, and people now understand that while children may remember slightly differently from adults, or their reasoning for what their understanding of why things happen may be different, that just because a child says this happened in their childhood doesn't mean that you naturally disbelieve it. So I think some of our visitors, who may not want to think they live in a country where medical experiments were carried out on children, and therefore have a strong pressure not to believe what they see, may fall back from that old rhetoric, well, you know, kids, memories, you know what it is. Of course, we're an exhibition in a museum, so we have to have objects. Now, there's kind of simple objects of trauma, I guess. The tractor seat that girls were had to sit on while they received vaginal examinations in Hay Institution for Girls is an obvious one. Or the strap, the strap which probably has a piece of hacksaw blade sewed inside it, so it's more effective in hitting children in a Christian Brothers home. And there's ordinary objects that have that gain emotions and resonance through where the context in which they're used. A kid's bed. What's a kid's bed? Think of the ad for the cough mixture and the kids being tucked in the bed and given the cough mixture and clutching their teddy. That's what bed is. It's safety for a child. But often in a home, it was not safety. It was a site of grief and fear and shame. You know, you wet the bed. How will you wake? You lie awake all night waiting for the person to find you in the morning. Or a teddy which has a smile stitched onto it by the child to try and cheer themselves up. They're objects that you can clearly associate with the experience of homes. But how do we talk about the trauma of absence in an exhibition? The absence of love, of particular caring, of belonging, that desolation that's often in the heart of the experience of a children's home. How do we represent that in an exhibition? Well, we're working on that now. And there's lots of practical measures too about representing trauma, which maybe we'll talk about later in the session. But I think it's really exciting that we're as a museum, a part of a process of working with difficult, painful and contentious histories. It's an incredible responsibility for us. That's a really, I think it's a wonderful thing for the museum to be taking part in. Thanks.
We now move to a slight change in perhaps the case study to the experiences of the Holocaust Museum. But I think what's emerged is so far is often the word that the actual name is interchangeable. You could take out forgotten Australians and put stolen children, convicts, you know, boarding school, whatever. There are any number of institutions or lives in Australian history or world history where you can see the same thing being repeated. And again, it's that general issue, the general discussion about how we represent trauma and how we can not just represent but consider and how it affects us, which is important. And on that basis, we'll go now to Jeffrey.
Thank you, Mike. Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for giving me the opportunity to speak with you today and be part of this roundtable. I want to thank Peter Stanley especially for making this possible. I don't suspect I need to spend a lot of time drawing out the connections between trauma and what we deal with at the Holocaust Museum, although certainly my perspective is different from that of Joanna and Adele and Jay, who have to deal with this on a much more personal, immediate level. And I'll point out at the start that as far as the exhibits at our museum are concerned, I'm no expert, I'm not a curator, I wasn't part of setting those up, although I can offer some impressions if you wish during discussion. My role is to compile and edit an encyclopedia of all of the camps and ghettos between 1933 and 1945. This is a 7-volume project. The first volume came out last year after about 9 years of work. And we're dealing with all of the types of facilities that the Germans ran. Concentration camps, POW camps, extermination centers, ghettos, forced labor camps, and another 20 or so categories that most people haven't even heard of, run by Nazi Germany and the states that were allied or associated with it. A system that ran from Norway to North Africa and from France to Moscow. We're covering approximately 20,000 sites in our encyclopedia, a number that surprised all of us when we started the project. Now, as far as representing trauma in our project goes, it's, in a certain sense, a fairly straightforward process. When we go to a contributor or I assign one of our research assistants to write about a particular place, we ask a series of questions. We ask that author to try to address these questions as fully as possible, having to do, among other things, with the number of prisoners who were there, the kinds of work that they performed, life and death within the camp, coping mechanisms that the prisoners came up with, significant events that may have taken place. The entries are limited in length. There's a lot of material to cover very often where there's documentation for it. And so the presentation, in a sense, is often rather dry, rather just, you know, one fact after another. But the best of these entries do include stories, anecdotes, if you will, from the camps. And even the ones that don't, I think people are able to get a feel for these places from looking at these entries. One of the main conclusions that I've seen now that we've been at this for a number of years, and Joanna's remarks reminded me of this right away, was that prisoners' experiences, and hence their traumas, varied tremendously, far more than I expected, I think more than most people expect when you're looking at this kind of system. They varied according to the kind of camp they were in. Obviously, a concentration camp is going to be different from a POW camp, different from a forced labor camp. They could vary from one camp to another within that system, according to the attitude of a particular commandant or a particular guard. Your prisoner category had a lot of control over the kinds of experiences that you had, whether you were a POW or a criminal or just thrown in because you were a Jew. And then your individual circumstances, any particular work talent that you may have had that might have gotten you a better job, or the kind of work assignment that you were given specifically within that camp. All of these could make a huge difference, often the difference between life and death. Now, from representing the trauma to understanding it, I don't know that I can claim that our project does that. I hope we can facilitate it. But whether we can really claim that to understand this, I'm not sure. That may be more than we can do. A lot depends on the kind of understanding that we're talking about. And I speak here as someone who has not studied trauma per se, except through this indirect way. Naturally, the focus for such an investigation is on the victims. And we do put the victims' voices into our entries as much as we can. The museum has other projects going that that address that even more directly. We have a Jewish Responses to Persecution documentary collection project that's going on, for example. What we can do in the encyclopedia is describe the conditions in these places, and as I say, to provide, you know, some anecdotes. And I think this promotes some understanding, as long as the person reading the material has sufficient imagination to sort of read between the lines, if you will. All the same, in our gathering here, I find that I have a lot more questions than answers. I think the scale of the phenomenon that we deal with is important. What does it mean when a trauma is multiplied by millions, perhaps tens of millions of people? Is that really what differentiates this series of historical events from one person's tragedy? Should we look at some sort of societal trauma as much as we look at individual trauma? How do those two balance each other out? On a related note, does it make a difference that this particular trauma was state-sponsored, like the one here in Australia? And the broader question for me is, are we really just scratching the surface with all of this? When can we say that we really understand trauma of this sort? What does such an understanding consist of? And I'll leave you with that thought. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.